I hear we're in a sexual recession, according to the Atlanta.
Is that right? But wait,
but we're not in a hot takes recession.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. My name is Jody Avergan. On today's show, we'll talk about the legacy of George H.W. Bush, 41st President of the United States, who died this past Friday. His legacy is notable for many reasons, but today, in no small part, because of how significantly his party has changed since his time in office. He's also the most recent president to serve a single term, and his loss in 1992 serves as a good case study for topics like the effects of the economy, war, presidential approval, third-party candidates, and of course, the media. So here, talk about it all, discuss a little bit how politics has changed since 1992. Our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. Hello, Nate.
Hello. How has politics changed since 1992?
No, don't scoop my first question. Claire Malone, politics writer. Hello, Claire.
Hey, Jody.
And managing editor, Micah Cohen. Hello, Micah.
Hi.
Later in the show, we're going to discuss voting irregularities and an investigation into election fraud in North Carolina's 9th congressional district. And then we'll end today's show with a conversation about some of the turnover in Congress and more how Republicans in Congress are pushing back against the president and how it has changed their positioning vis-a-vis their party. But let's begin with President H.W. Bush. Micah already scooped my first question. But no, look, at the risk of sounding very naive, does someone want to jump in and add some thoughts about how the Republican Party today is different than it was in the early 90s when H.W. Bush was at its head?
It's more extreme.
Mm-hmm.
It's more
barbed. What was the New York Times euphemism for, like, not saying racist or something? Barbed.
Barbed.
Racially tinged.
Racially barbed?
No, it's more extreme. I actually think it's more ideological but less driven by policy. It's more overtly racist. At least it's in its messaging and policy.
The overt part, I think, being important because race has always been
yes,
a big factor in American politics, and it's often not overt, and it has involved at times both parties.
But George H.W. Bush is actually a great example of how it's always been there. I mean, look at his 1988 campaign against Dukakis and the Willie Horton ad and Lee Atwater. You know, that was not far beneath the surface in that mm-hmm. election.
Yeah, and his history on race is pretty mixed. I mean, it's not my area of expertise, but he has some accolades, too, in terms of, for example, I believe getting like the NAACP more involved and things like that. But clearly the Willie Horton ad was a form of racial dog whistling, and the two campaigns that he ran in 88 and 92 are interesting because, like, these are races that were really dynamic, where the polls moved around a lot, where, you know, I'm not totally sure it's obvious in either 88 or 92 who should, quote unquote, have won. It's not an election like 2008, for example, or 1980 or 96, where things seem baked in based on incumbency and economics and everything else. And so those are two really interesting elections to study.
If I could have covered any campaign, it would have been that 92 campaign where Perot was in, then dropped out, then got back in, and it was just seemed like a crazy
campaign.
Is this
a chance to plug that we've done a good documentary and podcast documentary about that very race? And
yeah, you should go back and listen. It's a crazy story. Shout out to Galen in the control booth. The other thing I would just point out that I think has changed is I was, you know, looking through some of George H.W. Bush's tenure, and at the height of his popularity, which was after the first Gulf War, Bush had a, according to our tracker, a plus 78.4 net approval rating.
Right.
Plus 78 points.
That's crazy.
That is crazy.
What was his son's right after 9/11? Had to have been up there.
W got up to 78.1.
Yeah.
So he almost got there. But it's an example of, I think, sad to say maybe, but even if we had another 9/11, God forbid, could a president get that high in approval rating?
It's a really interesting question. I don't know.
It's not really pleasant to think
about. Yeah, that's not pleasant to think about.
Forget the terror attack. But I'm just saying, like, aren't things too partisan now where, okay, so plus 78. So Bush's approval rating, not his net approval rating, was up to 86%. Mm-hmm. So 86% of the country approved of the job he was doing.
But during his tenure, his approval rating also did drop down into like the 20s. And so I wonder if maybe we've talked about what's different, but does he feel like also one of the first presidents where this hyper-partisanship roller coaster was in play in a way that it obviously is right now?
Well, no, the opposite.
The opposite.
Right?
The opposite.
Because it's partisanship that regulates for Obama.
You're
Trump,
never going to drop too low. Or you're never going to. Right, right.
I don't know if you want to predict how high or low in theory Trump's approval rating could go. But, like, no, it was a less partisan era, and that's what made elections a bit more
That's why so many people voted for Ross Perot.
And a lot of people voted for Perot.
Yeah.
That's the first election I kind of remember. And just like the idea of Ross Perot being around all the time was, he was like an interesting.
My friends Jeff Ray and I went as Perot, Bush, and Clinton for Halloween.
Mm-hmm. Which one were you?
Oh my God.
I was not.
I think you would have been Perot.
Yeah.
I think maybe I was Perot.
Yeah. One other thing that has been trotted out a little bit in the last few days has been the notion that, you know, during Bush's time, there was more collegiality and the more comedy between the two parties. And people are citing this note that he wrote to Clinton when he left office, wishing him luck. Claire, is that the kind of thing that just happens when a prominent politician dies and people look for kind things to say? Or is that really something? Is there some there?
I do think there's some there as far as I think there used to be more politeness in politics. We'll also say, like, just as a related aside, that politics used to be largely populated by white men. So there's some.
So it was like more collegial, but like
but
that's because.
There was a reason.
Right. It was clubby.
It was clubby. So, but yes, I think people have talked a lot about how Bush was a very sort of generationally polite person, gracious person. And I think that a lot of people have seized on that letter because they can't imagine Trump, say, losing in 2020 and writing a gracious note to his Democratic successor.
I mean, part of this is also part of it's nostalgia, right? But it's like nostalgia in the media kind of coupled with the notion of, oh, this was like the quote unquote good kind of Republican, right? I think that's why some of this feels like it's a little bit. Maybe not overdone, but like he has a complicated legacy. If
but
you
expand
want to
on
invoke,
that.
I'm just making an observation as a media critic / whatever else, right? And maybe it's a little hypocritical because I have a fairly warm overall impression of H.W. Bush also, right? But it does seem to me like there are efforts to say, hey, look how fair we can be to Republicans, where this is one of the good Republicans who play by the rules and, you know, yeah, he had some problems, but like this is how American politics should be, and so we're going to go out of our way to tell positive things about his legacy, right? Like the AP like deleted a tweet or an article or something that like said that like, oh, he had been defeated in 1992, which is a fairly significant part of his legacy. There are not that many one-term presidents.
Yeah.
At some point Jimmy Carter will pass, and it'll be interesting to see how he is treated. Of course, he has had a very honorable post-presidential career.
Secular saint Jimmy Carter.
Yeah, but also a presidency that like might be considered somewhat unsuccessful. I mean, Bush is a weird case, though, because I think he is someone whose presidency has aged fairly well.
Very
and he
well.
Was a one-termer, you know? And so it is weird. I mean, I was, you know, talking about, like, media in another direction. It was also a time when there was a lot of media narrative about how Bush was out of touch, and there was this basically BS story about a supermarket scanner, and there were things about him being a wimp, and there was a Dana Carvey impression, and, like, which is... and it was, like, just a weird... I know, when I was growing up, right?
Yeah.
So it is, like, I think a little bit of a mystery why he plummeted all the way to, I mean, there was no new taxes, right? Why he plummeted all the way to 31% or whatever he was before recovering a little bit at the end, because he wasn't failing in the ways that presidents who get that low typically
fail. And there was a recession, but it had started to recover by the time.
The recession, so the job rate, the unemployment rate was still going up. A lot of other indicators were improving, on the other hand. But yeah, the recession was not declared over until December 1992. It apparently actually had ended in spring of 91, right? So recessions are an imprecise thing. We could be in a recession right now, people. We wouldn't even know it yet.
Nate, are you, just to push you a little bit more on that, are you saying that you feel like there was a big kind of media narrative that took hold around H.W. Bush, especially in 1992, that was disconnected from reality? I mean, are you kind of getting at saying, like, this is where some of those bad media things that we try and push back against came into play?
I'm saying it's a time when, number one, I think the media narrative was very powerful in the sense that, on the one hand, media is becoming more sophisticated. Cable news, CNN is on the rise. You don't have MSNBC and Fox News yet, you know, and so it's becoming more invected political coverage as compared to how it was 10 or 20 years earlier. On the other hand, it's still kind of a monopoly, and so you don't necessarily have like pushback from internet-based sources, pushback from, oh, I guess Rush Limbaugh was around then, right? Mm-hmm. But you don't have as much pushback from like right-wing talk radio. You don't have Fox News, and you don't have fact-checkers. You don't have MSNBC. And so it's kind of like, you know, if you look at the story of how the New York Times and certain other publications ran with the supermarket scanner story, I mean, this was basically completely misinterpreted by a reporter who wasn't even there at the time, right?
So for people who don't know, the common narrative was that George H.W. Bush came across a supermarket scanner, you know, where they scan the prices, and was like, oh, this is
what
amazing,
is this? Yeah.
As if he had never done it before. But in reality, it was like this new kind of scanner,
well, and
right?
He had spent the whole day looking at a bunch of stuff, and then that was kind of the last stop on the day, and he was like, today was amazing. I saw a lot of amazing things. He happened to be standing near the scanner, and someone picked up
on
it.
And also, if you're at a big supermarket convention and someone's showing you, it is apparently a cool new scanner, if they're showing you kind of how it works, and you would at least, as a
nice person,
feign interest.
Yeah, like when Micah publishes a piece, I'm like, oh,
that
was
good.
I think we also should remember that the Reagan conservative revolution had sort of matured during the course of H.W. Bush's presidency, and so when he broke the no new taxes thing,
right,
people in the party already recognized Bush as a moderate in many ways, a person who was actually himself very different from Reagan, I guess biographically, as a sort of patrician son of the East Coast, and also politically as a Republican with very moderate stances, and I think saw, you know, definitely were probably more eager to put their knives out, you know, and then you saw 2 years later Newt Gingrich and the big sweeping revolution. So I think that he was also caught at a weird time for that party.
That's a really, really good point. Yeah. Let's talk about one more thing and then let's move on. But voters themselves, were Republican voters more open to a collection of policy positions back then in a way that they aren't now? Is there just something about voters in 1992 versus voters now that is worth saying at this moment?
You know, some of the background to this too is like, this is an era when the South was transitioning away, or the quote unquote deep South at least was transitioning away from Democrats. Look, Clinton did well in the South in 92 and 96, but he had struggles back and forth between kind of, you know, Republicans, the Northern Democratic Party, and the Southern Democratic Party. And what happened is that like a lot of the Southern Democratic Party got absorbed into the Republican Party, and that had lots of consequences for how campaigns were run, had lots of consequences for racial politics, I would argue, in particular, and which party those tend to be housed in more. You know, look, I mean, we also, it should be mentioned, had, with the exception of a recession early in Reagan's term, the 1990-91 recession, we had very strong economic growth under Bush and Reagan. And this was an era when the middle class was benefiting, as they did under parts of the Clinton boom, too. So this is an era when people felt pretty good, like that their end of the deal was being held up, when there was a prosperous middle class and, you know, more economic mobility than there is now. And so, you know, so that's important background to all of this as well.
I'm trying to think if there's any significant way in which voters were different, let's say in 1992, than they are now. I'm not sure. I mean, I guess the only thing I'd say is what we said at the top, which is the parties were less well sorted by ideology and race. And so, for instance, both parties basically pushed a quote-unquote tough on crime.
Yeah, it was a more conservative time in America. I mean, I do think that like that 8 years of Reagan and like
that's
the prosperity of Reagan like had seeped into American culture. And also, I think, I mean, Clinton ran as like a radical moderate, right? Like he was gonna be like a conservative Democrat. Like in many ways, he was just an old school, so like moderate Southern
Gary Hardish,
but I certainly think that there were trickle down effects culturally from the Reagan era,
and certainly on foreign policy as well. I mean, you know, no one was carrying the, well, I guess maybe for a little bit, but no one was carrying the isolationist mantle in the way
mind your
Trump
own
was.
Business.
I mean, you did have at one point a Democrat had only been president for one of the past six terms heading into 92. So to go back to the point about like the media narrative polling for Clinton, you know, a lot of it was like, hey, a Republican is always president, and we're really tired of a Republican always being president, and so, you know,
and this guy plays the saxophone.
And this guy plays a saxophone, and he's good looking, right? And he's charming, right? And he's scandalous, and so he gets ratings for us because he's controversial, and then that flips. And then 2 years later, the House, which had always been Democratic in the era, flipped the other way. And so, you know, so it was a time when, you know, whatever stasis we had in American politics, I think you have that being upended.
Have any of you watched those CNN series that called like the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s? I think they just showed up on Netflix.
I think I've caught like glimpses of
them. They're pretty solid. I rewatched some of the one, not because of the death of H.W. Bush, just because I had run out of other things on Netflix to watch about the 90s over the weekend, but it touched on a lot of this stuff, so it might be worth checking out.
What happened in the
90s? Well, you have to go find out. Beavis and Butthead.
90210.
Yeah. NYPD Blue.
I wasn't allowed to watch any of these.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on and bring it back to the present. Listeners, you thought that all of the tallying from the midterms was over, but it is not. We're going to look at North Carolina's 9th district. The race there has not been certified because of irregularities that have led to an investigation into possible election fraud. So we're going to talk about that. But first, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by GiveWell. Many people, it's the holiday season, they want to start giving their money to a good cause, but it's hard to figure out what a good charity really is. Well, GiveWell does in-depth, detailed research to identify evidence-backed, cost-effective programs helping the poorest people in the world. At GiveWell.org, you can see a very short list of top charities that have met GiveWell's exacting standards. GiveWell is unique in this sense because it focuses on how much good a charity accomplishes. For instance, how many lives does it save, or how much does someone's income increase with each dollar donated? Other places focus on easier to answer but less important questions like how much a charity's CEO makes or how much overhead it has. Its current top charities do things like fund programs to prevent child deaths from malaria or provide direct cash transfers to very poor households in East Africa. You can go and dive into all the details if you are interested, but if you just want to spend a few minutes, you can go and see those top charities and leverage the hundreds of hours that GiveWell staff has put into finding exceptional charities to recommend to you. Make the most of your giving this holiday season. Take 2 minutes right now and visit GiveWell.org. Once again, that's GiveWell.org. We're back, and joining us to talk about the investigation into possible election fraud in North Carolina is politics professor J. Michael Bitzer from Catawba College in North Carolina. Hello, Professor Bitzer. Thanks for joining us on the 538 podcast.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
So just to give a sketch of the news, last week, the North Carolina Board of Election met with the expectation that it would certify the results of a very close election in the 9th district. The Republican there had eked out a 905-vote lead. Instead of certifying the election, they decided to hold off because of irregularities in mail-in ballots in particular and those numbers, and they are now investigating possible fraud. So you want to talk a little bit about what those irregularities are and what else we need to know about the state of this race?
Sure. There's a couple of things going on that I think have caught people's attention. First and foremost, there were several affidavits filed by voters in Bladen County, which is a rural county in the eastern part of the district. They allege that people came to their homes and said, "Hi, I'm here to pick up your absentee by mail ballot." And some of the voters gave over their ballots, perhaps unsealed. And there's some question about possible manipulation or tampering with those absentee by mail ballots. What another aspect that really caught my attention was that among the vote results for absentee by mail, Mark Harris, the Republican, received 61% of the absentee by mail vote from Bladen County. And Bladen County can be a pretty reliable Republican county. But in comparison to the other seven counties, Dan McCready won the absentee by mail vote in every one of the other seven. So that one stood out. And then when I dug deeper into, well, who actually cast and accepted absentee ballot by mail in Bladen County for the 9th Congressional District, only 19% of those ballots came from registered Republicans.
And I'll just clarify that Dan McCready is the Democrat in this case.
Yes. So it was surprising to see a vote method which had only 19% registered Republicans, but end up being 61% Republican, meaning that either every unaffiliated voter had to have voted Republican who cast an absentee by mail ballot and also get some crossover registered Democrats. Now, that's a possibility, but it just seemed rather extreme for that kind of difference between the vote totals and who was actually showing up to vote in that method.
I have a statement and a question, I guess, right?
Go for it.
The statement is that, like, this stuff kind of jumps off the page, right? There have been various times when you have allegations of irregularities. Sometimes you have counties where, for example, in Florida, this year was a ballot design issue. And if you look carefully, you can see that sometimes there are claims that are wrong, right? I think there were claims made about the presidential vote in Wisconsin and Michigan and so forth in 2016 that, like, just didn't hold up at all, or at the very least were completely not obvious from looking at the data. Some of this stuff, to me, kind of just pops out, you know, the lopsided nature of the absentee vote in these counties. But the question I had is, what is about Bladen County in particular is just like where this one potential consultant was operating, or why would this occur in Bladen County and not in other parts of the district?
I think that's an excellent question. I'm not sure we know all of the factors quite yet. It would certainly seem that the consultant may be at the heart of what will finally unravel in terms of the evidentiary hearing that the North Carolina State Board of Elections will hold about this. You know, there have been suspicions about Bladen County in previous elections, particularly in the primary election this past spring for the Republican nomination, as well as in 2016. But the patterns, you're right, just seem to be so odd out of one county. Another aspect that I find really surprising is that out of Bladen County, 40% of the requested absentee by mail ballots were never returned to the County Board of Elections. Now, in that district, that's actually the second highest non-return rate. A county by the name of Robeson County had it in the low 60s for a non-return rate. So, you know, as I've described it, were voters just lazy and requested the ballots but didn't return them? Maybe that could be the case.
Just to jump in, I mean, a couple of voters have signed affidavits that say that a woman came to their house saying that she was collecting absentee ballots and that they gave her their ballots without the ballots being sealed. Obviously, this is illegal, but there is some implication, right, if we read between the lines, that potentially if something illegal happened, it was that someone was taking those ballots and voting for the Republican on those mail-in ballots. Is that it?
Potentially, but Professor, I guess I was confused about this point too, is what I totally get why the absentee by mail vote going so Republican in this one county, despite the sort of underlying party registration numbers, why that totally pops off the page, particularly compared to the other counties. But why would the number of non-returned ballots there be a tip-off? Is it what Claire's saying, that they would alter it or that they would dump them if they were for Democrats?
We don't know, but yeah. My suspicion could be that if there were people going around collecting absentee by mail ballots and those ballots were not secured in the envelope, that the collector, as I would call them, could have access to that ballot and see how the individual voter decided to vote. And if it wasn't, shall we say, the right candidate, maybe that ballot never saw its way back to the County Board of Elections. I think all of this is certainly speculative, and we're waiting for the evidentiary hearing to be held. But there just seems, for that high of a rate of non-return, something seems to be amiss.
There are two ways you could sort of cheat. One would be by, like, kind of collecting ballots from people who thought they voted and then throwing them out. And the other would be by, you know, so there's some analysis just reading now about how apparently a lot of infrequent voters requested absentee ballots. So one thing you could do is say, okay, this person requested an absentee ballot and maybe they didn't know they did it because the request was put in by someone who wasn't the voter himself or herself. And then, I don't know, you go in and collect it and fill it out or something. It's hard to think that this would happen organically, you know, without someone doing something, I guess. And that sounds like a little vague.
Can we ask a bit about, I guess, the political history of this county?
It is certainly a rural county. It is a part of what we call the Black Belt here in North Carolina. It tends to have a high African-American population, but it's a fairly small county in the 9th Congressional District, which kind of hugs the South Carolina state line with North Carolina, starting in Charlotte and then basically running east along the South Carolina line towards the coast. In terms of the political history, it's kind of been a traditional Republican rural county, with the exception of 2008 and 2012, when Barack Obama did very well because of black enthusiasm and black voter mobilization and showing up for the elections.
I mentioned that this vote was at 905 was what separated it. I mean, just to be clear, we are talking potentially about a level of fraud that would have affected the outcome.
Well, you hear that on one side of the political aisle in this state, and the other side of the political aisle would say there's not enough ballots that are questionable to alter that 905 number. I don't think either side at this point can truly make a definitive statement other than there are some anomalies going on with these ballots in both Bladen and I would also toss in Robeson County to call into question what exactly is going on. Now, the state Republican Party has been using the line, there's not enough ballots to alter the election outcome, so it should be certified. In the general statute for the North Carolina State Board of Elections, it says nothing about their discretionary authority to certify an election, even if there are improprieties. And, you know, the board could make a decision if they believe the election is, quote, tainted enough that would call the integrity of the entire process into question. So the next couple of weeks is going to be critical in terms of how the State Board of Elections looks at the evidence, tries to understand what is going on, talks to people, talks to voters in those counties, and tries to figure out what exactly is going on.
You know, we've talked a number of times on this show about voter fraud, tampering, irregularities in an election. I mean, is this the kind of thing, Nate, Claire, Micah, that we have been talking about, or is this somehow anomalous to that?
It's different in the sense that, like, I don't think anyone is saying that voters themselves tried to commit fraud, right? What they're saying is that some third party was gaming absentee by mail ballots in one or two of these counties. And so it's not like we, you know, it's not like some voter trying to vote twice or some, you know, person who's not a legal immigrant trying to vote if they're not a citizen or whatever else, which is what usually when Republicans talk about voter fraud, this is organized by some people and we don't know who would have knowledge of it. I mean, I did want to ask one more question to the professor, but tell me more about this Board of Elections, because it's like it's nonpartisan and like the chairman resigned, but who are the people on it? What reputation do they have? What incentives do they have? And frankly, do you have any sense of how they're likely to rule?
This could be another entire segment for your podcast on the status of the North Carolina State Board of Elections. We had a constitutional amendment that went down to defeat that would have kept the current structure of 4 Democrats, 4 Republicans, and 1 unaffiliated voter in place. What a court has ordered was that after the election was certified, that the current state board of 9 members would be disbanded, and that conceivably the old system, the old structure of 3 of the governor's party, along with 2 of the opposition, would constitute a new state board of elections. Well, with this 9th congressional district question, it hasn't been certified. So the state board is technically still in operation. And last Friday, a court ruled that they could remain in operation for another 2 weeks. Over the weekend, the Republican Party went after the Democratic chair of the board, and he has resigned from the board. So there is a lot of uncertainty going on in terms of, is this current structure going to stay in place? Who is leading that current structure? And if we have a new structure, do they pick up the continuation of the evidentiary hearing and investigation? I've been studying North Carolina politics for over 15 years in depth. I couldn't tell you what's going to happen in the next couple of weeks. So I would welcome anybody's crystal ball because mine is cracked.
We always like when our guests are willing to admit that they don't know what comes next. But one thing that does come next is even if the Republican gets certified by North Carolina board, he shows up in a democratically controlled house in D.C. and they can decide whether to seat a member or not, right? So this could go on and become national, right?
Yeah, I mean, Democrats control the House and the House and the Senate have the authority to not seat members. And I think certainly if there is a dispute over the legitimacy of the election, that would pass constitutional muster. Whether it's in good judgment or not, you can argue about. But like, it is hard to prognosticate. And if the board is able to rule before it gets disbanded, I think what they might say might have a lot of influence. Yeah. You know, I tend to think if it can be demonstrated that there was widespread fraud by someone who worked maybe indirectly on behalf of the Harris campaign, I tend to think it's hard for there not to be a new election. Just thinking through the politics of it, right? Because like the argument that, yeah, this guy did these things and it affected several hundred votes, probably not enough to affect the outcome. And oh, by the way, it's not actually clear I should have won the Republican primary either because there were also anomalies in that race and that was a big surprising upset, right? You know, I don't think that argument is super tenable because to me, maybe there's an innocent explanation. I haven't heard anyone come up with one for like how this could have arisen naturally. But like to me, Harris's best case scenario was arguing that this guy was a rogue operative and we didn't know about his history because he has a history with this and the firm I hired him. So there's two layers of disconnect. And yeah, this was bad, but like we're not sure that it affected whatever the margin was, 900 votes, right? That's kind of like the best case scenario for him, I think. And even then, I'm not sure that either North Carolina or the Democratic House would not want a new election. And then there are scenarios where it's worse, where you discover problems that clearly are more than enough to cover 900 votes or where it seems like Harris has some or Harris's campaign manager has some knowledge of this.
But what one thing this got me thinking about, I'd be curious for the professor's thoughts, is kind of what evidence counts for what with the American public and with elected officials, you know, where the statistical evidence here is pretty stunning and as you guys were saying at the top here, kind of pops off the page. But probably for people to, let's say, not seat Harris, if we get to that point, you'd probably need non-statistical evidence, emails and testimony. And
a smoking ballot.
Et cetera. Right. It got me thinking sort of like just what role kind of math and numbers play in how we process evidence versus in science. I'm like way out over my skis here, but we'll like figure out there's a planet or a star somewhere, not by seeing it, but by noticing that like a star or a planet nearby wobbles a little bit in its gravity. In other words, you just kind of you can infer something based on numbers and data and crunching the math, but like not actually seeing it. And it feels like here, at least in American politics, we'll have to see it. Do you think that's right, or do you think just the math might be enough?
I think it will have to be something that will peel away the partisan lenses of the average American voter. And that's difficult to do in any way, shape, or form nowadays, unfortunately, because of the polarization that we're experiencing. I sent out a tweet that had a bunch of numbers in it, and someone who identified as a strong Republican tweeted back, "I don't believe those numbers." And the numbers came from the State Board of Elections. So I think the affidavits, and if they are true, help to paint a story of what potentially could have happened and how it happened. But beyond that, I'm particularly in this state, as polarized as it is, I think we're into one side is not going to be happy with any decision that's made.
I'll add, Micah, that your question could very much apply to the Mueller investigation as well. I mean, we've talked a lot about that. So, look, there's lots to watch for, and maybe we will continue to have Professor Bitzer on. And, Michael, you mentioned your Twitter handle, and I will point out that it's a wonderful one. You are at Bowtie Politics, and there is a picture of you wearing a bow tie. So people can go follow you there for tweets that include both numbers and GIFs and pop culture references.
That'd be a good name for a website.
Bowtie Politics. Do you own that URL?
I don't.
Okay, we're going to go buy it right now. We're
going to
do it before this comes out. And
you should buy it before it airs. Yeah.
Okay, Professor Bitzer, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Again, Professor Bitzer is a political science professor at Catawba College in North Carolina. Now let's move on to our final segment. Before the midterms, we asked how a Democratic victory might change Republicans' behavior in Congress, whether it would make them more open to pushing back against the president, for instance. So we will discuss that. But before we do, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by Lightstream. This holiday season, give yourself the gift of extra money in your pocket. What a nice gift. When you consolidate your credit cards with Lightstream. Lightstream offers credit card consolidation loans from 6.14% APR with autopay. Compare that 6.14% to the national average credit card interest rate, which is over 19%. That is blows my mind every time I read it. Get a loan from $5,000 to $100,000, and you can even get your money as soon as the day that you apply. The application is 100% online, and there are no fees. This holiday season, save even more with an additional interest rate discount, and the only way to get it is to go to lightstream.com/538. That's lightstream.com/538. Subject to credit approval, the rate includes 0.5% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Once again, visit lightstream.com/538 for more information. lightstream.com/538. All right, we're back. And for the last few minutes here, let's just have a kind of bigger think conversation about that very question that I posed, which is, does the big Democratic victory change the way that Republicans will behave in Congress? So, Micah, I'll let you take the first crack here. Have we noticed the GOP acting differently since our blue wave election?
I think it's too early to say for sure.
Yes, classic 538 answer.
But I think the early evidence is that congressional Republicans in the Senate are a little more willing to push back on Trump.
How so?
Two discrete examples. One is Flake, who for a long time would push back rhetorically on the president but never really did anything about it, said publicly that he would sort of block any judge until he got a vote on some legislation to protect Mueller. Then Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina also came out and announced that he would oppose this one of Trump's nominees for a district court seat, Thomas A. Farr, who I guess was had a whole host of controversies. They blocked him. They basically scuttled that nomination. The other kind of discrete example is that the Senate, including 14 Republicans, advanced this resolution to sort of take away U.S. support for Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen, which again, I won't admit, Claire probably knows it more than me, but is tied to the whole
Khashoggi.
Yeah, I don't know how to pronounce that. But yeah, and Trump has taken a very soft line.
That's a good way to put it.
And so I think there you see sort of Senate Republicans, at least some Senate Republicans, willing to push back on the administration's policy towards Saudi Arabia, which...
And I think Republicans have demonstrated in the past that they're willing to push back on Trump on foreign policy. You saw people during various dust-ups with Putin's Russia saying, we need to... pass these hardline things. We need to expel, this number of Russian diplomats when there was the poisoning of the ex-spy in the UK. So I think that there's, in part because I think Republicans probably rightly guess that their base is a little less tuned into the intricacies of foreign policy and what's going on. But I think that they, especially with the Jamal Khashoggi dust up and the way that Trump has sort of really, really taken the Saudi line on multiple policy positions, but the way he has taken the royal family's line about this murder of this journalist has been alarming, I think, to U.S. politicians who see it as potentially enabling future strongman leaders to act with impunity. And I think that they see that Democrat and Republican as a problem.
But so I guess the reason I led with it's too soon to say is because I think both of these instances in which Senate Republicans have sort of pushed back on the president are significant. But as Claire said, we've seen cases like this before.
They've and just Flake is retiring and has always said it's my retirement that's the thing that's letting me step out against Trump, not the fact that there was this wave election. So can we attribute any of this behavior to something that's different since the election itself?
I don't think yet, but that was what I was saying is like we've had two significant ones in less than a month. Now in 3 months we might look back and we're like, oh, that was a coincidence. Just so happened those things came up in the month after the midterms, or maybe we'll look back and say, okay, that's when they started.
I mean, I think we've been waiting for a long time for there to be some big precipitating event that involves Trump firing someone or pardoning someone or the Mueller report itself actually dropping are kind of the big three categories. And none of those have happened yet. And maybe we'll be taping an emergency podcast in the week where one or more of those things has happened. I don't know. Right. Look, if you were a Republican and you were convinced that Trump walked on water electorally, which I don't think she'd ever been convinced of in the first place, but the midterm provides a pretty powerful rebuke to that. And in fact, the Times had an article about House Republicans, and they seem almost fatalistic about the fact that, okay, well, when Trump is on the ballot, it's going to be a disaster in the suburbs. We're helpless, which is kind of BS, right? Like, one of the reasons Republicans lost in the suburbs is because they passed this unpopular tax bill that limited for wealthy people in high-tax states the amount they can deduct from state and local and property taxes. Another reason is that this health care bill was really very unpopular, and so Republicans in the House have a lot of blame themselves to go around, but I think they're resigned to just saying, you know what, as long as Trump's on the ballot, then I guess we have to cross our fingers and hope we win the Electoral College and we'll win the Senate because it's lots of red states, but gosh, you know, there's not much we can do about it, and in fact, maybe more of them are going to retire instead of having to deal with Trump. And so, you know, but clearly, at the very least, the article shows that, like, there is a recognition that electorally that he can bring disadvantages, and if you believe that politicians are within certain scope rational, and you know, you wonder if they're thinking, gosh, is there some way that we can dream of not having Trump? Should we be thinking about the long term? I mean, we should probably write up, like, what about these Republicans who do kind of tend to defy Trump, like Will Hurd or someone, right? Or a couple in upstate New York, do they actually survive? Did that work? Is that a viable strategy or not? We should do that article, Micah.
We should.
Nate Rakich should do it.
But Nate made this point in an article. But if you're a Republican looking around, not only did you lose a lot of ground in the midterms, but you lost a lot of ground while Trump's base came out, right? Yeah. So it's not a question of, you know, I think a lot of these elected officials are rightfully electorally terrified of Trump's base. But what 2018 showed is that's not the only thing you have to worry about. You have to worry about, even if that base turns out, the rest of the country.
And does this scan historically? I mean, is it usual that when a party loses big in a midterm, do they then start to push back and do some soul searching with vis-a-vis the president and maybe sort of be more willing to push back against them? Or is it more like, what's our policy position? How does this feel like compared to previous elections of this kind?
Historically, parties take defeat pretty seriously, right? And so you have this kind of long history of presidents doing badly at the midterm, which very often happens to a president. And this was not the worst loss that a president's party ever took.
But they don't assess who's at the top of their ticket.
But, well, I guess, yeah, I guess, like, there's maybe, you know, I mean, I guess there isn't talk of, there's no talk about, like, replacing Clinton in 94, right?
Right, or however, replacing Obama after the shellacking.
But you do have presidents who triangulate and lean into, at least rhetorically, you can argue Obama didn't actually do it substantively, right? But at least rhetorically, for some period of time, lean into the fact that, no, this was a little embarrassing and we have to reach across the aisle and do the whole both sides thing. I mean, Clinton did that much more explicitly. You know, Reagan after 82, which is not that bad a wave, but, like, there was lots of discussion about how he's going to cooperate with Congress and find common ground. And Trump has not consistently had moments like that. I mean, you can see that he has some impulses. He praised Nancy Pelosi. He kind of oddly, like at some point, by his standards, like praised like Stacey Abrams and Andrew Gillum, right? And so there are like there are times when he seems to show that instinct, you know. But so there are two questions here. Number one is like, okay, so you have the fact that historically midterm results don't predict what happens to the presidential year very well. However, you also in that data set have parties who are adjusting. And so the question is Trump capable of adjusting? You know, my question is sort of a, you know, constitutionally, is he capable of it? I'm not sure. You know, I was on a panel with a couple panels with Chris Christie, former governor of New Jersey, and our ABC News colleague last week. And, you know, and Chris talks to the president and Chris was kind of saying, don't underestimate this guy because this guy has fairly good instincts for when he's in trouble. I'm paraphrasing.
Mm-hmm. Chris. I have buddies with Chris Christie now.
And so, you know, so, and he's not necessarily that much of a partisan, so he is maybe capable of change. What I wonder, though, is like, given the background of the Mueller investigation, which is going to become very partisan, the reaction to it, how much would that derail even a disciplined president's efforts to try and be more bipartisan? And then given that Trump is not the most disciplined person, you know, that might seem hard, or I don't know, but Democrats can also overreach, quote unquote, and everything else.
Well, one thing, which is I guess I discounted Teddy Kennedy primarying Jimmy Carter in 1980. So there is a little bit of a,
yeah,
the party can revolt a little bit. I don't really think it's in Trump's instincts to be more bipartisan. Like, I have a really difficult time seeing him react to the midterm defeats and or big allegations from Mueller with a sort of, you know, soothing balm of bipartisanship. It just doesn't seem to be in his repertoire.
No, and we would have seen, I think we would have seen more of that instinct if he had that instinct.
I don't think we expect Trump to see Democrats doing well and then reach out. But if there's a sizable number of Republicans who are breaking with him, is that something that then could get Trump to shift and shift tack?
I think it would just attack him.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, I think it would be, I think in that case, I think you see a Republican primarying mm-hmm. Trump. I mean, that's my instinct.
No,
I don't
right.
know.
Which probably wouldn't be successful, but you'd at least see it.
Hasn't Kasich kind of...
Yeah, he's going to run.
Yes, but Kasich isn't... like...
That's all you need to say. Say no more.
Let's take it seriously. John Kasich is a pretty conservative Republican, actually, by pre-2016 standards. Like, this guy has some pretty... Particularly on, let's say, like, reproductive rights, you know, that's been kind of Kasich's thing. But he took the, like, moderate Republican stance against Trump, has a big ego, right, and was running for president probably far past his viability point. But I do think that he has staked out this place as the conscientious objector, and it has made him, I don't know if it's made him popular nationally in the Republican
Party.
Popular
in the media, but not with Republican
exactly.
voters.
But I do think, I mean, if you are like, if you are a Republican who is a dedicated never Trumper, although that term of art seems to have fallen out a bit, then I think you would throw your support behind Kasich, knowing that it would split a vote to Ross Perot Trump a little bit, right? That would be your hope, is that not that Kasich would win, but that Kasich would screw with Trump or fill in the blank someone else besides Kasich.
Are you saying, and are we saying, Mike, you can jump in on this, that the pushback against Trump is going to go into that primarying him bucket from the GOP, or should we look to the Romneys, the Gardners, the Collins, the Murkowskis to potentially like band together and really say we're going to jam up this person's agenda in the Senate and not just have it be part of the presidential election?
I don't think the right question is how is Trump going to react to the midterms. I think it's how will Republican mm-hmm. congressional Republicans react to the midterms, and I think the jury is still out on that. So like, sure, Romney and Gardner and Murkowski and Collins could band together, but they haven't yet. And it's I think we have to kind of wait and see if they do. I don't actually know. There is this history of presidents, at the very least rhetorically and often policy-wise, responding to midterm defeats. I don't actually know if there's a history of like congressional caucuses clearly reacting to elections. It's just like there are many more people, so one is just harder to...
Well, typically it flips over. So one party, the party who is the president's party, loses control of one or both chambers of Congress. And so, you know,
they band together.
So you get into legislative stalemate because, I mean, that's more of a recent development, right? You know, when Reagan lost the midterms in 82, right, then there was a notion of like, oh, we're going to pass some tax bills with Democrats and, right. and et cetera, et cetera. But like, let me ask a question for the other three of you, because it's a fun question that you can argue both ways. Do you think the conventional wisdom right now overrates or underrates Trump's chances of being reelected?
Great short little question.
Over.
Under.
Wait, I'm sorry. Under.
It underrates it.
Underrates.
What do you think the conventional wisdom thinks it is? Yeah. I mean, you can go to the Scottish teens at predictit.com.
What do they have?
The Scottish teens at predictit say that Trump has a 34% chance of winning a second term.
That's very
oh wait
low.
Your question.
Scotland
was,
has a historical affiliation with the Labour Party. We should discount the Scottish teens.
I still think under though. I think
yeah, I agree yeah. under.
I think over.
Give us your argument.
You think well, and where do you think the Scottish teens land? You think they're about right?
That's a little too low, I think.
But give us your argument.
I don't know. Look, I mean, so the naive explanation is that midterms aren't predictive. And also, although he's unpopular, that approval ratings 2 years out are not predictive of approval ratings on the day of the next election 2 years later. And so therefore you would default right now to the prior that incumbents get reelected 2/3 or 70% or 75% of the time or whatever it is, right? On the other hand, like, Trump is Trump, and like I guess you can make like lots of famously wrong predictions by saying that, oh, okay, we expect Trump will defy history when actually some of these historical patterns are pretty reliable. And part of the historical pattern is that usually the president's party gets beat up quite a bit at the midterm and the president comes back and wins. But it's a little bit like, you know, how much is the Mueller investigation the elephant in the room? How much is Trump's behavior itself the elephant in the room?
They're both elephants.
My God, I've had this conversation for like 3 years.
Oh, well, you're going to have it for two more.
But it's interesting that according to the market, Trump is sort of 50-50, except he has a significant risk in the primary. That's kind of weird.
It's not a risk of losing the primary. It's a risk that he
gets
wounded implodes. Gazelle.
But he gets impeached or resigns or I don't know what, right? But like,
here's the way I think about it. Trump as an incumbent president is more likely than not to win re-election. So let's put him at like 70%. But there's this non-trivial chance that Mueller comes down with like a lightning bolt that would significantly hurt Trump. So shave 20% off that. So I put at 50-50.
Let's start to wrap this up because as Claire hinted at, this is a conversation that is going to go on for a while. We will continue to have more iterations of this going on. I don't know. Should people continue this on Twitter and tell us where if they think – what's the question? Do you think the conventional wisdom is over or underestimating Trump's chances of re-election in 2020? Let us know. You can tweet at us or you can email us podcast@538.com.
So here's what I think.
Okay, yes.
Can I say one more?
Yeah, but
I sure. think the conventional wisdom – overrates Trump's political acumen. I think it does not necessarily overrate the chances of him being reelected because at this point it's early enough that prior still has to be weighed mm-hmm. fairly heavily.
Okay.
But I do think people are like, oh, Trump's tough to beat. He's wily. I mean, he just, you know, he lost the popular vote by by 2 points in winning the election. Then the Republicans lost the popular vote by 8.5 or 9 points in this midterm, it looks like. And so, you know, that wouldn't portray someone who is particularly good at developing a majority coalition.
Okay, that is our final thought. Thanks to you, Nate Silver.
Thanks to you, Jody, for hosting the show.
Thanks to you, Claire Malone.
Thanks.
And thanks to you, Micah Cohen.
Thank you.
My name is Jody Avergan. Galen Druk is our producer. Tony Chow is in the control room. Again, you can get in touch by emailing us podcast@538.com. You can also tweet at any of us, and maybe you can jump in on this question or anything else you have to say. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.